Accession number 8171, reel 23.
Mr. Metalman, reel 23. When you went back to Germany, what year was it?
It was 1948, the early part of the year. I can't remember exactly the months, but I think something end of February or beginning of March. It was cold weather. I remember that.
What were conditions like for ordinary people in Germany at that time?
Oh, very bad. I came by train with a transport through Holland, I think we came. We crossed into Germany at Bentheim. And we drove on, by train, we went on to Münster. And Münster was a kind of assembly camp where all the prisoners, I assume all the prisoners, went, and from there on they actually were released by the British authorities. The British army was in charge of that camp. We stayed there a few days, and already the journey towards Münster came through part of the Ruhr area. The devastation we saw, which were brought newly into our conscience now after we had been for so long in England, and the war had been over now for, approaching 3 years, and we hadn't seen Germany since. It was terrible, because one still, suffered from that patriotic, that strong patriotic feeling on which we had been brought up. I still considered Germany was something very special, that I still was a proud member of the German nation, the feeling of racial superiority, I still had not really lost. It had been put into me very deeply. When I thought about that, I realized that it must have been like that. And I was very hurt to see so much destroyed and to see the German people walking around as I had seen the Russian people walking around in their hour of greatest need, when they were really down. Now the German people look to me the same. The clothes they wore, you could see it, old stuff, and the women wore headscarves around their heads, like the peasants from Eastern Europe, showing that there wasn't much clothes about. My mother had recently died, and I had sent her clothes from England. That's why I know that they couldn't get anything in Germany. I sent her everything, shoes and jackets and underwear, whatever I could buy in second-hand shops in Britain. And it was a feeling of, not only that my pride was knocked down, but real sadness. There was hardly anything in the shops. Food, it was not too bad at that time. I don't think that people actually were starving in 48. Many things were still rationed. And, when we arrived at the barracks in Münster, the food was okay. We stayed there for several days. I can't remember for how many days, a few nights, until we got our papers. As it so often happens with these arrangements, the British Army, they had put Germans in charge, German officers, German NCOs. They were actually the ones who were dealing with us. The British were in the background, the officers or so. They hardly dealt with us on a direct basis. So we came under the command, as one can say, of these German ex-officers and ex-NCOs. and they started treating us there as whether we were in the old army days. And we revolted. They told us to line up. We refused to line up. Then they threatened us, I remember at one occasion, okay, if you don't want to line up, then we won't give you any food. And we were saying, oh, who do you mean we? Who are you, we? We are German prisoners and we are here under the British, and you are, without asking the British or telling them even, you come to us and you say that you are threatening us. You are a prisoner, or whatever, whoever you are, or even if you are released. Who are you? And at one occasion, a fight developed. One of us, he got very angry and said something about cigarettes. He said, oh, well, if we give you some cigarettes, cigarettes was in those days was a currency in Germany, used as a currency. If you had cigarettes, you were a rich man. If we give you cigarettes, is everything all right? That's most probably what you want from us. Something like that, he said. And one insult followed the other, and there was a fight, and they knocked that bloke down. And then some British, was it military police? I'm not quite sure. Came in, and the whole thing then was kind of swept under the carpet. But there was that strong feeling of we came new now to Germany, and we somehow were disturbed by it all, and we noticed that there was much corruption going on, black market, and not knowing really what was going on. I think it brought it about that a kind of enmity, or how can you call it, perhaps not as strong as enmity, but very much distrust of everything we met that was in the foreground.
What were attitudes in Germany at the time? Can you remember what people's attitudes were?
Yes, because, as I said, we stayed there a few days and then we got our railway tickets to the destinations we wanted to go. And, of course, the condition was at that time, I haven't mentioned it, if we wanted to come back to Britain, if we didn't like it in Germany, and we had a job in Britain, as in my case, the Colonel Courage, a brewer I had worked for as a farm worker, he had offered me a job back. He said, Henry, if you want to come back, you can come back. As far as I'm concerned, you can work for me. So that was a condition. And we were being told that if we report to the, what do they call it? The transport officers, I think, RTOs, who was at every station, main station in Germany. If we reported to them, we had certain bits of paper, within 4 weeks, then we would be provided with transport, with railway tickets, and so on, to go back to Britain. And I made use of it later on, within the 4 weeks. I arrived in Hamburg, and to see the devastation again. It was just terrible. Everything was flattened, and people were, well, resigned, very much resigned. And looking at it with the eyes of later years, in those days I had always, I saw things and noticed things, and it takes me always the time to digest these things and analyze them. They were resigned, they were disappointed that we had lost the war. The saying was going there all the time, oh, well, we lost the war now. They can do everything with us, what they want. They can tell all the lies about concentration camps and all the horrors we have supposed they tell us we had done. And they forget all about their own horrors. They because, after all, if there is a war, there must be two, at least, who are involved in it. And they are just as guilty as we are, but our crime was to have lost the war. At that time, I already was very dubious of that, because I had seen too many things in Russia to say to myself that our crime was having lost the war. I knew there were other crimes, and I knew there had been crimes against humanity on a large scale, and to my shame, I collectively had taken part in them. My parents were dead. I arrived in Hamburg, and I stayed with friends, very nice friends whom I had known from in our street. They lived a few houses away, and for that reason they took me in. Conditions were very cramped. There was the father and mother, and the son had married, and now I, on top of it, we all slept in one bedroom. It was a double bed. The old couple was sleeping in one bed, the young couple next to them, and I was sleeping on a kind of a couch at the side, so a very unsatisfactory arrangement, of course. I had some uncles and aunts, but they too, most of them, were bombed out, and I visited them, of course, and in no way were they able to put me up. So that, I think, was perhaps the main reason, or one of the main reasons, why I decided to go back to England. And also, I did not like the whole attitude. I've begun to feel at that time that at least we should search for the origins of the war, the reasons why all these horrors had happened. We had started this kind of talking about in the prison camps already in America and also in England. And I found that was lacking in Germany. Whenever one mentioned the war and the crimes, the first thing that always came to the forefront was an excuse. Oh, well, yes, now that was war. Or, yes, well, we have been beaten now. And, oh, yes, well, we had to attack the Russians because they otherwise would have attacked us. And there was something in it that our Führer, he was wise in as much that he struck before the others were able to strike at us. And, well, we have lost it now. Nobody would listen to us anyway now what we are saying about that. But the Bolshevik Jewish plutocratic organizations, they had it in for us. And yes, well, there have been some crimes, but of course, crimes always happen in war. War is a crime. Nobody of any sense wants a crime, but there was always this, then the but, and then there was no real attempt to analyze and no real attempt to find out. And I had several discussions with school friends I met there of my own generation. The older ones, they didn't want to talk about it, but the younger ones did. But they were more resentful than acknowledging the fact that surely something must have been wrong with us.
What were they resentful against?
That we had lost that war. Still, the feeling among the generation, my own generation, you must understand, we all had been years in the Hitler Youth. It really had been drummed into us that we were something special, the chosen race, as the Jews called themselves. We considered ourselves a modern version of that, that we really were a superior race. And you have to understand also that as far as just looking at the war, the military things are concerned, that we were very successful, even if we were beaten, that we were very efficient. We were saying, now, look at our nation, we are 70 million people, and we were fighting the Americans, the Russians, the British, and so many more. We must be something special. There's no nation which could do that. So the reason for that pride now was still there, and even was now being nourished on defeat. showing, we were defeated, but how could have had it turned out otherwise with so many powerful states arranged against us. I do remember one of my schoolmates, Werner Stahl, I think was his name, definitely Stahl. He had been in the SS, and I met him in Hamburg, and, come, let's have a drink. So we went into a pub and had a drink. And at that time, I was just thinking about now going back to England, and he said, and you don't want to do that, or this is... Oh, England, what's England? They are on this slide down. I said, well, what about us then? If you talk about the slide down, he said, there's much in us still. Okay, we have lost the war, but we are a very strong nation economically, industrially, and military. It will come again. You wait, he said. We had a meeting with all the old SS blokes. He said, where he served in the SS. Of course, I was not in the SS. And I'm sure, Henry, I can get you in somewhere. I got good connections. So I realized that if you had been in the SS, there were some connections for you. And I thought, well, that's... what's the moral value of that? Because one thing by that time I had developed in my mind was a... not only a critical analysis of the whole Nazi ideology and the Nazi state, but definitely a strong distaste for anything connected with Nazism. And now this—he was a decent bloke. I don't want to say anything about my schoolmate Stahl. He was young as I had been in the SS, and I can understand all that, how it came about, because if one would have offered me to go into the SS when I was full of my Hitler Youth ideas, it's quite possible that I would have done the same. So I will not say he was a positive criminal by having gone into the SS. But that now, 3 years after the war, that they already had SS meetings, and that he more or less told me that everyone who was in the SS is all right as far as jobs goes and everything else. And he even mentioned if I want to go abroad, South America or what, that can be arranged, but you still work for Germany, he said. Even those who go to South America, they for a time they go away, but it's still Germany, great Germany.
Do you think it was true that there was an effective SS sold by network?
Yes, I cannot prove it, but by the way he was talking about it, yes. And what I know about it now, it still exists today. I don't know, have you read The Odessa File or something like that? I know, it's a novel. But surely all those leaders of the SS and other well-known Nazis who have disappeared to Latin America mainly, that was all well organized, and they still have connection with powerful financial and industrial groups now. Because quite a few who went to Latin America or to Spain, like Otto Skorzeny, they became very successful businessmen, and largely because of their connections with German industry. They had close links with German industry. Those who are still there in Latin America, in Paraguay, is it Bolivia? I don't know exactly where they all are, but mainly I understand in Paraguay, because they got a Bavarian German president there, Stössner, who still talks, or is supposed to have talked. I never have been there, I don't know, with a Bavarian accent. And I understand, have read in the press, in the responsible press, not in the Gada press, that Hitler's birthday and certain battle days are still being celebrated there in Asuncion, I think is the capital of Paraguay.
Was there any sense of criticism of the Hitler government amongst Germans after the war?
No, that was, well, of course, to say there was none, yes, there was some. But there was still a sense of fear. Still people did not dare really to say too much against the Hitler regime. It was still hovering in the background. It was known there were powerful people, as from the SS or so, who were still around. I think there were some political murders. I'm not quite sure about it. I think there's something in my mind that there were political murders, that those who said bad things about the Hitler regime, that they were still dealt with by criminal means in many ways. I remember, for instance, when I came to America in the prison camp in Arizona, where I was, shortly before I came, they had hanged someone within the camp who had dared to speak out against Hitler. And that was just after the war. That was a few days after the war, that somebody, I think he was an Austrian, that he had rejoiced in it, Hitler dead and all that, and then they found him hanged. I think the American authorities, the army, they took them to court-martial or what. That happened in Arizona. And I heard afterwards it was not the only case. And I sensed it wherever I went, and with my relatives, for instance, they were ordinary people. Nobody had ever achieved any political or in business or what. They were working people. One or two had managed to get a little shop, not beyond that. But even in the close family circle, when one said something about the war and about Hitler, and they didn't want to know, they didn't want to talk about. And I found that disturbing, and I think that I wanted to get away from it all, and I felt that coming back to England, at least within myself, I could think about these things, I could talk about these things, because I felt it a great pressure on my mind, on my intellect, that I had gone through something like that, and Germany did not want to know about it. I found it depressing.
But was this unwillingness to talk solely a question of fear, or was it because of maybe bad conscience or some other thing?
Well, perhaps to bad conscience, the guilt. Of course, 6 million Jews are supposed to have been killed, and I think that probably all right. I mean, I never have seen a concentration camp, and I don't know exactly how many, but surely there must have been quite a few who have known about that. Obviously, I mean, you can't have killed these many people. Then I have seen on transports or so, when I was on railway transport in the East and also in Germany, transport of people in closed railway wagons. You saw them looking out the little slits, the little windows or so, and so it was known. People had seen that. But if I talk about my own feelings for that, I honestly, I did not know during the war about the killings. I knew there were concentration camps. I didn't know about the killings. And I felt very strongly that anti-German elements have to be dealt with sharply. Okay, that was my generation, and that wasn't talking about me personally. I don't want to excuse myself in any way, but just by explaining my own feelings and thinking of that time, perhaps one can learn from it. To say that my generation, that there were very many who really did not know about the killings, but there must have been a large number too who had known. And, well, I'm not a psychologist, but I can imagine that all this must have put a weight on the German mind that people kind of didn't want to talk about it. I think that that too must have played a role.
I'd like to ask you some questions now about things you've said. First of all, going back to the Russian campaign, did you see much evidence of scorched earth policy?
Oh, yes. Yes, scorched earth policies in both directions. Of course, it is known, I think I'm talking about historical facts now, that it was really introduced by the Russians in the first place. Stalin had introduced the scorched earth policy when the Russians retreated. I've seen many blown up bridges and industries destroyed. But on the whole, they left the lives of the civilian population intact. They didn't destroy the houses, the cottages of the people. But industrial complexes or so, I saw it very much in what they call the Donets area. I remember I was in town, so we came through at Krivoy Rog and Golovka and Artomovsk and Lugansk. And later on, out of that area in Rostov, I saw it, which is quite an industrial center too, that the Russians had destroyed many of these complexes. And of course, they had tried to get machinery out of it. But it's a very different story, of course, with our scorched earth policy. We destroyed everything, of course, obviously, to prevent the following Red Army to move fast. We tried to do it for that reason. But there was also a revenge sentiment into it. We tried to blow up everything we possibly could. And as during the time of the retreat, I think I mentioned it earlier, that there had been a change in the attitudes of the Russians towards us, where at first they were very fearful. They still were very fearful then. But they knew that a dawn was coming for them and that we were on the way out. And I think there was a strong revenge feeling too. Wherever we could do any harm to them, we blew up everything possible. Railway junctions, all bridges, every building of any meaning, whether it was a library or a museum or a railway station, the station buildings, where we sometimes did not blow up cottages was in order to save our loads where you blow it up with. We thought we could sometimes a cottage, we thought, oh, well, to go to all the expense and blow that up. If we could burn it down, we burned it down. But we saved our material, the dynamite, whatever it was, or sticks, something like that, for better things. But there was a strong feeling of revenge and nastiness.
I wonder if you could say something about the standard of Russian equipment that the Soviet forces used against you. I'm talking about arms and things of this kind, because some of the British people I've interviewed who are PRWs, who saw the Russians coming into Germany at the end of the war, have talked about the poor quality of Soviet equipment.
Well, poor quality of Soviet equipment. They had have beaten us with that equipment, surely. And if it was poor quality, well, what was wrong with us then? I think I mentioned it before. For instance, I had learned to drive the T-34 tank. And I never drove it in action. And yes, within the tank, it was not as complicated as a German one. You didn't have the proper gauges in there, in the Russian tank, but it was very effective. It was knocked together. I sensed that they were very much under pressure, for instance, when they built that tank, to just get it out, knock it together and get it out. They refined things or so. They were left out. Their weapons, other weapons, we used, for instance, one which we called the Rajbomb, the 7.62 anti-tank weapon, which was also an artillery weapon, which was a very good, effective weapon. Outwardly, it looked pretty rough. The machine guns, machine pistols, even optics, they were good. Now, our machine gun, if we got some sand in it or some grit in it, it stopped firing. Whereas you could put it into the, throw it on the ground and got some dirt in it, and it still was going. There was, of course, a great difference